Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. It's January 5th, 2022. So here we are, one day shy of a year since the January 6th Capitol riot that left five people dead, 15 police officers hospitalized, that one gets forgotten, and conservative America's commitment to democracy in doubt. And now comes new reporting that rather than being chastened by the tragic fruits of what they did and pull back from their extreme views and activities, the militia members and white supremacists so central to the insurrection have used the past year to try and build on January 6th to increase the power of their movements by getting more involved in local politics in communities around the country. Let's find out more, including how much they're succeeding or being rejected, from Brandi Zadrozny, senior reporter for NBC News, who covers misinformation, extremism, and the internet. She's also a fellow at Harvard Shorenstein Center. Her story out this week is called From the Capitol to the City Council, How Extremism in the U.S. Shifted After January 6th. Brandi, thanks for taking some time away from the network to come back on the show. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Your article begins with the story of a militia member named Denise Aguilar, who was there on January 6th, praised the, quote, patriots who broke open the doors, but you find her at a school board meeting near Sacramento. Tell us a little bit of the Denise Aguilar story, if you would.
Sure. So Denise Aguilar is a California mom. She has been pretty active in the anti-vaccine movement before this, starting in California when they were trying to pass some laws getting way of religious exemptions for childhood vaccinations. So she's been sort of a low-key activist for a while. But 2020 came, and like many like her, people who had never dabbled in politics or thought about activism slowly became mass radicalized, is the phrase that we're sort of using and experts are using. And that led her to the State House to protest COVID vaccine, COVID precautions, masks, and then the coming vaccines. She was detained by police, and eventually it led her to the Capitol, where she was part of this Health Freedom Summit on January 6th, and she gave a rousing speech. And then, according to her now deleted Instagram video, she was bare-maced, and she said, "We stormed the Capitol." And she said, "And we will continue to storm Capitols as we go home." And she went back home. She's not been storming any Capitols. Instead, as you said, she has been doing this sort of small-time work of local protesting, going to city council board meetings, going to school board meetings, which her children do not attend, the public schools, of course, but arguing and fighting to do away with like mask mandates, vaccine mandates, the culture war stuff that we're seeing a lot of around the country.
Wait, her kids don't attend public school, and yet she's getting involved with the local school board to tell others what they're allowed to do?
That's absolutely true. And it's, I've been watching a lot of school board meetings, which is weird as an extremist reporter, but I've been watching a lot of them. And that is a recurring theme, that a lot of the fights that we're seeing at local school boards, from, you know, so-called fights against critical race theory or mask mandates, stuff like that, most of the speakers that are against those things and are the most vocal are usually not parents of children in the district.
And what's the Denise Aguilar story representative of? There are many Denise Aguilars. Are there many Denise Aguilars getting more involved in local politics around the country after they supported or participated in January 6th?
Yeah, I think it is part of a broader transformation by specifically the extremist groups that were there, right? I think that the stat is something like 1 in 10 of the 700 people arrested and charged from the Capitol riots were part of a known extremist group, right? And so many of those people, yes, it's very indicative of how their groups have come home and are doing sort of small time, you know, work. They had a sort of cooling off period, and now they're focused on local politics, specifically school boards, county health boards. And they do this as a way to sort of not only battle their PR crisis, right? Because they were widely condemned following the riot. Everybody could sort of see that with their eyes. And most people would say that's going too far. And so a way to engender support is to sort of glom on to the larger culture wars, mainstream conservative movements. And so you see, for instance, Proud Boys at a, you know, North Carolina public health meeting against masks, and they're just sitting in the back. And so a lot of the people that are there sort of support them. You know, they clapped for them. They were glad they were there. And not all of those people are extremists, right? And so you sort of, they get into the mainstream that way. And then they also use it for recruiting. So like that North Carolina meeting where the Proud Boys showed up, they used the media from that, made posters of themselves sitting in the back, menacing, all in masks and looking quite scary, and said the tagline was "saved you a seat." And so, you know, the message being, we are involved in local politics, get involved to join our group. And so it's this sort of cycle of recruiting, propagandizing, and then also engendering support within your communities and then widening out broader.
To what degree is this being centrally directed? For example, you wrote that by last spring, there were internal calls in far-right circles for them to refocus, including by Steve Bannon, to what you call his far-right nationalist foot soldiers. What did Steve Bannon say, and what was the context for that?
Right. So there is no national thing to bring everybody together, right? There is no election right now. There is no rallying cry to unify people on the far right. And so leaders of the far right, from not only, you know, Steve Bannon on his podcast, but also you have like hardcore white nationalists, and they are all calling to refocus on these local groups. So Steve Bannon back in the spring said basically that people need to retake the country village by village, right? And so ProPublica actually had this great investigation where they followed up on that. And after that call, and he has a ton of podcast listeners, it's a very, very popular podcast, he found there was this really crazy increase in local level party officers, you know, doing just what he said, right? Filing to be involved in their local level politics. So I think it's incredibly popular. I think that we see it not just in, we see it with the QAnon thing too. We've seen an uptick in QAnon members running for school board, running for low level public office, like with a vacuum of a national unifying topic. What's happening is that people are going to local levels to affect change.
This may be an uncomfortable question, but if the far right is participating in school board democracy and county health board democracy and things like that, that's not the same as trying to kill Nancy Pelosi and Mike Pence, right? Or stage a coup after a legitimate election. Is it wrong to demonize people we disagree with as a threat to democracy for getting involved in democratic institutions?
I think that's a really fair question. And it's one that's been proposed a lot. Like that's what you're supposed to do, right? If you want to affect change. And I personally think that's fine. My job as a reporter is just to document. So if we see that there is a contingent in the United States, a growing contingent of domestic extremists, right, that pose a real threat to the country, according to the FBI and law enforcement agencies, and, you know, extremism researchers who have said that right now we have a bigger domestic terror threat than we've ever had ever. So I think that it's fair to say to look at what they're doing, and especially when it's described like Nick Fuentes, for example, on his podcast, his live stream, he has blatantly says that it is a tactic, right? It's a tactic that works. And so it's not just, if you cover school board meetings, you cover local politics, you're used to getting the wild ones maybe. But it is important that we realize that this isn't just local people getting involved in local things. It's blatantly a strategy to grow their movements and move the mainstream conservatives farther towards the extremes.
Listeners, we invite your January 5th questions for Brandi Zadrozny, senior reporter for NBC News, on her story about how extremist groups are going local since January 6th, 212-433-WNYC. Are you seeing this in your local school boards or health department politics or anywhere else? Help us report this story. Help Brandy report this story. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or tweet at Brian Lehrer. What about in your social media feeds on local issues or anything you want to ask Brandy about her reporting and her beat of extremism, misinformation, and the internet? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. You write that it's not just the strategy that has shifted, this going local. Most far-right domestic extremist movements have also adapted their infrastructure and messaging, according to a report you cite by the Digital Forensic Research Lab at the Atlantic Council, an international affairs think tank. What did that think tank find?
Well, it found that just sort of what we said, that there was a brief cooling off period. Sort of people went back home and learned very quickly that you shouldn't record your crimes and or alleged crimes and then telegraph them to the world. And so people stopped sort of doing that, stayed off social media. A lot of the forums sort of went away, including stuff like The Donald initially took their stuff offline, places where we had seen lots of threats leading up to January 6th, explicit threats about the Capitol, that went away. The biggest militia forums went away. And a lot of the people were banned from, including President Trump, who tech platforms determined had instigated the riots. They were banned. And so there was this, according to the report, there was this sort of reshuffling and evolution, really. A lot of the actors have created their own platforms. White supremacists have created their own streaming platforms. Everybody seems to have a podcast right now or a streaming program right now. And that's according to Megan Swire, who works at the Southern Poverty Law Center. And she tracks this stuff and watches way too much of this videos. But, you know, it basically said that these communities were still very much intact. We just don't see a lot of them anymore. And that's the infrastructure. And in terms of the messaging, again, just like we sort of talked about, it really is culture war stuff. So CRT, race,
critical
education.
Race,
yeah, critical race theory, education, local elections. And all those things come together
in terms of different strategies and different messages, ways of messaging. I get it. So one underlying question that I have is, do you think the far right, after I guess what they acknowledge was an image hit because of January 6th, has gotten stronger in the year since January 6th, meaning winning more supporters to their belief systems through these strategies you're describing, or gotten weaker because other conservative Americans have been repulsed by their tactics and extremism?
I mean, that's hard to say. The far right, I mean, we don't want to mischaracterize it, right? Like the far right has reemerged, and especially like let's look at, you know, the white supremacist or white nationalist movement. Like we have seen them come back on the streets in a way that we haven't seen since the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville. Like groups are now doing demonstrations. In DC, there was a recent one. And then there was also one in Wisconsin with a group trying to sort of suggest that the mass killing of a group of revelers was somehow race related, which there's no evidence to that. And so anyway, we have seen sort of people start up again in a way that sort of suggest confidence in their movement. But we have no reason to believe that those are widely popular. What we do have reasons to believe is happening is that, you know, the idea that a lot of people don't think January 6th was a big deal anymore, the last year has sort of softened the public outcry for conservative, at least in conservative circles, that January 6th was not that bad, right? It's quieted the condemnation of that. And so that seems to suggest that they, these groups will have a sort of warmer home to come to. Also, when you're looking at these local events, like I'm watching a lot of them, and they, a lot of like Patriot Prayer in the Pacific Northwest, when they staged an event outside of a public high school, they had mainstream conservative support out there as well. It wasn't just Patriot Prayer. You know, they had people glomming onto that messaging. And I think that what that shows is that if you have the right message, people are willing to overlook quite a lot. Like you had, even on January 6th, like you had Proud Boys marching with like little grandmas, you know, saying stop the steal. And I think if there's a big enough messaging, whether that's COVID stuff, maybe it's the midterm elections, whatever it is, like you will find these groups come together again. And so I think that that while they may not be outwardly popular now, like people aren't rallying to support the Proud Boys necessarily, but what you do have is I think that you have a general acceptance of this group if they have the same message as you do.
Yeah, I think that's a really chilling and important part of the story, the sort of mainstream cover that these groups are getting. And I think we have a caller relevant to that point who wants to bring in something else from history as a point of comparison. Raymond in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Thank you so much for calling in today.
Yeah, good morning, Brian. Thank you very much, and good morning, ma'am. Well, I'm a vet, and, you know, and I was looking at, you look at Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, you look at the Black Panther movement, which was a community group, really, you know, and the government labeled them as almost like terrorists. All these groups, either jailed, and most of the activists were killed or murdered. But yet these guys committed treason, really. I mean, they were, there was treason what happened in the Capitol, and they're getting slapped on the hand. And these Proud Boys, they're treasonous. They, you know, they're going against the country. Any other group or any other organization, people of color are treated differently than these guys. And I don't think that's fair. I know we're not naive in thinking that this is okay, but it's not right.
It's not right, and it's certainly different. That cover that they get from aspects of the mainstream, as you were describing, Brandy. Right? Anything to add to what Raymond had to say?
No, I mean, I think it's fair to say that dozens of Proud Boys have been arrested and charged from their activities at the Capitol, and I know that there was a situation in the Michigan Capitol where militia was heavily infiltrated by the FBI. Some countered that it was a little too heavy-handed, and so I think that there's more cognizance and there's more understanding about the role of law enforcement and the tragedies of the past and the missteps of the past and the mistakes of the past and the crimes of the past when it comes to these activist groups. And there's a lot more eyes on them too because of social media, right? And so like it's a real challenging time, but that also, I think that those, what happened in the past in terms of how the FBI and how law enforcement targeted specifically like Black or activist groups generally is that I think that is part of the reason, and these right-wing groups now use those examples as a way to suggest that the government is after all of us. It's just an interesting moment because I see a lot of those same calls specifically in propaganda for these right-wing groups, specifically anti-government groups like Boogaloo or the militia groups.
Mm-hmm. Alexis in Red Bank, you're on WNYC with Brandy Zadrozny, who covers the internet, misinformation, and extremism for NBC News. Hi, Alexis.
Hi, good morning. So, Brandy, I love the way you're reporting this because you're not taking neutral to the point that you're not being realistic about what you're seeing, which is really important in today's reporting. I happen to live down the road from Governor Murphy here in New Jersey. And some of my neighbors, some people that I really love, they are right-wing radicals. And they have won the school board elections, ousting other people that I really love that are really smart people. They are using Nazi imagery, which is so frightening. The people that actually won our school board election took a picture of Hitler and superimposed it on Governor Murphy's face and posted that on Facebook. And these are the people that won the election. And there's more to this, but, you know, I don't want to take too much time, but these are the types of things that are winning.
Alexis, thank you very much for that chilling story from Red Bank. Is that the kind of thing that you're hearing and seeing more of in your reporting on extremism, extremism going local?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that we've seen a real increase. I wonder if, and I don't know if Alexis is still on the line, and Alexis, DM me on Twitter, please. I'd love to talk more about it. But, you know, a lot of this Nazi iconography and imagery and sort of using Hitler as a reference in the Holocaust as a reference for what's happening with COVID restrictions is just so prevalent. We just saw, I mean, Marjorie Taylor Greene, the congresswoman who was just banned from Twitter, talked about it all the time. There was this big issue with people using the Star of David as a, you know, the yellow star as a sort of image that claimed that they were being persecuted like Jews were persecuted during the Holocaust because they were asked to wear a mask in public spaces or get vaccinated for their job. It's just incredibly prevalent right now and really disturbing.
Well, so far we've been talking mostly until Alexis just brought up the internet about old school analog politics, right? Like school board and county health board public meetings. But part of your beat is misinformation on the internet. So where does the internet come in to your going local story?
Well, a couple of places. I mean, what I think is so interesting about the local meetings is that they're more than just local meetings now, especially because of COVID. And even before, everything was recorded, right? And so what you have are these local meetings actually being just a reason to record your message and then post it to social media. And often it's the wilder, the better, right? Alex Jones actually of InfoWars actually has this sort of contest running right now for who can get his misinformation and conspiracy theories about COVID onto mainstream media and news. And he says, do this by going to public meetings, record yourself saying them, upload that and send it to the news, and then it'll be on the news. So it's actually, these public meetings are a vehicle used in part of a pipeline that involves social media. So that's sort of one thing that I find incredibly interesting about our information landscape and how they're using it, how they're using, you know, these long-held public places to further that misinformation. But also,
go ahead.
But also, you know, the internet's obviously a really important part in this, right? Like when we look at January 6th, you can't tell the story of what led everybody there without talking specifically about Facebook, which was just a sort of incubator of misinformation and disinformation about the election. ProPublica just came out with this great report where they unearthed, I think, 650,000 posts in Facebook groups that were pushing this lie from the election all the way to January 6th. That's like 10,000 posts a day, right?
Yeah.
So that's a big deal. And we still have that problem. Facebook has banned a lot of people, but Facebook reacts reactively. And so are they prepared for the next threat? I would argue absolutely not.
Yeah. Wow. It also, as I'm listening to your story about Alex Jones, it presents a challenge for people like me and you, institutions like mine and yours, NBC News, as to when to resist taking the bait, even in the name of pointing out extremist involvement. So if he's telling his followers to go to things like local school board meetings, record themselves saying something false and outrageous, and upload it and hope that the, you know, professional media pick it up and report it, well, how would we report it? We would report it as, look at this dangerous extremist showing up at our local school board meeting, but then their word gets out through us, right?
Yeah, I mean, I don't do that kind of reporting. And I would suggest that others steer clear of that as well. I think that there's an important part in reporting any kind of information. And it's I think about it a lot when I think about anti-vaxxers who do the same thing. They go and do protests so that they get their signs and their message on national media. Like that is the goal. And so it's the same sort of thing with, you know, the KKK putting flyers in library books or diaper bags. They want their message to end up on the news. And so if you're the news, I think an important gatekeeping responsibility you have to do is to say, why would someone want me to report that? And do I want to do their messaging for them? And then resist the temptation to do that. The problem is that we have news outlets right now that don't have not a shred of responsibility and don't think about that at all. And that's everything from the Daily Mail and to, you know, OAN, a far right television network. And so the traditional gatekeepers have far less power. And so it's just really difficult.
Listener tweets. Also, GOP and the right have long focused on state and local elections. That's how they own redistricting. Democrats don't, which is an apt observation. In fact, I was thinking we've seen this before, like in the 90s, the religious right, Christian Coalition, the Pat Robertson, Jerry Falwell movements, that sort of thing. After Robertson's failed presidential campaign, got very involved with school boards to promote Christian education in public schools. They even ran some candidates here in New York City that got some attention at the time. And we certainly see their influence in education policy long term in this country. So maybe this is a new generation of that.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, I'm old enough to remember even Common Core, right? And the Tea Party's rise. Like right-wing groups, for whatever reason, are far more active at the local level, far seemingly better at organizing. And I'm not a political reporter, so I can't go much into why, but I agree.
Right. You're an investigative reporter covering extremism and misinformation. And Jerome in the Bronx has a question for you in that role, I think. Jerome, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. So my question is, have you run across any information about who or what organizations are funding all of these activities, especially the ones that actually cost money?
So that's interesting. My beat is the internet, which is sort of like the telephone. So it's hard to sort of say like this. You know, extremism is funded by blank. But I think if we're talking about the school board issue, you can see that the longstanding conservative groups like, you know, the Heritage Foundation, groups like that are still funding the same organizations. And those organizations are now just shifted to fight CRT or the issue of the day or masking or whatever it is. So a part of this is still held in the hands and funded by the coffers of your, you know, Manhattan Institute, your normal, your known conservative movements.
Supposedly mainstream, respectable conservative institutions. Before you go, I know that your story is part of NBC News series this week that features a variety of in-depth stories on the state of extremism in America. And I saw that you retweeted a quote from a story by your NBC News colleague, Jonathan Allen, that compares January 6th to the first World Trade Center attack, the one in 1993 that killed six people 8 years before the big one, of course, on September 11th, 2001. Covering extremism as you beat as you do, why did that quote jump out at you, that 1993 First World Trade Center attack comparison?
I mean, Jonathan's story was amazing. But I want to even bring it further if I can. I talk to extremism researchers all day long. And I think at this point, like it feels like an unprecedented sort of time for domestic extremism. But I think that everyone is sort of holding their breath and looking at what the next tragedy will be or what the next big violent moment will be. And I don't want to pontificate, but it's a lot, like a lot of people are looking towards the Oklahoma City bombing. A lot of people are talking about, you know, after the World Trade Center bombing, or the planes went into the World Trade Center, the knee jerk, maybe too big of a response by mm-hmm. our law enforcement and our government. And I don't know which is correct. And mm-hmm. I don't, and we talk about the tech companies being reactive, and it feels like that's all that we're doing too. We're just reacting. I haven't found a historical parallel that's that I find necessarily correct yet. But I think that it's important to consider all of them.
Well, we've never been in this moment before, that's for sure. And sometimes history repeats itself is too easy a cliche when history goes out in all kinds of different new branches, and we have to adjust in the moment. So Brandi Zadrozny, senior reporter for NBC News, who covers misinformation, extremism, and the internet, also a fellow at Harvard Shorenstein Center. Her story out this week is called From the Capitol to the City Council, How Extremism in the U.S. Shifted After January 6th. Thank you so much for your reporting and for sharing some of it with us.
Thank you so much, Brian.